Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More about me at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, today I get to speak with Hanuman Das, who's the chairman and founder of GoDharmic. He's also the co-author, along with Dr. Nick Sutton from the Oxford Center of Hindu Studies, of three books, previously The Power of Dharma, Pearls of Wisdom from Hinduism, and brand new out in 2022 from Jayco, Moving Mountains, A Guide to Hanuman Chalisa. Hanuman Das, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being on.
Yes, indeed. It's my pleasure. So what is this GoDharmic thing that you're the founder of?
So, good question. I've spent the last decade trying to figure out what it is myself, but Dharma, as Mahabharata would say, is subtle.
Sukshma, yes.
hidden within the cave of our hearts and not available just to thoughts or words alone. So as we try and promote a more balanced or realigned approach to living in the world, GoDharmic is a request. Nick, who you mentioned, is co-author, often jokes that we should have called it GoDharmic, please, because we're all about human values and kindness and compassion and the values that we represent. So GoDharmic is a humanitarian organization, but more than that, it's an attempt to build a community of love and compassion. And I believe that every school of Indian philosophy seeks to reduce suffering as its goal. The common factor is a state of no suffering. And therefore, when there is suffering in front of us, we should go dharmic to reduce that suffering in any way, shape, or form that we can, whether that's mental, physical, economic, any way we can, just try to work to reduce suffering.
So what's the primary work of the organization?
The primary work is to establish Dharma, to create Dharmic people. And that means people who value love, compassion, service, friendship, truth. And then from that point, feeding people, ensuring that, in a city like Glasgow, where there's 46% food waste, food is thrown in the dustbin, but 36% of children are going to school hungry, empty stomachs, eating poor nutrition. Can we work to solve that? Can we right that wrong? And so it's food distribution, where our volunteers have distributed more than 6 million meals around the world through their compassionate action, developing libraries for girls predominantly across India and Nepal, establishing libraries, disaster relief. Volunteers come together to serve people who may be suffering in a cyclone or cloud burst in Uttarakhand in the Himalayas when we have that. So the outlets are many. ways and means of delivering dharma or dharmic action are many, but the core should be that, you know, as Maharaja Yudhishthira in Mahabharata, we want to choose the dog more than we choose Swargalok or heaven or you know any choice in that way. So
it seems to me there are two levels of discourse. Perhaps there's a discourse of the humanitarian work that you're doing as an organization and the nuts and bolts thereof and who you serve and how you go about doing so and how folks can contribute. And then interspersed with that, perhaps even powered by that, is this very Indic conception, formulation of virtue, of righteousness, of duty, of dharma. So for the second piece, that overlay that's so important, we'll dive into that a little bit momentarily, particularly as a foyer into your co-authored books, just for so folks can get a clear sense of the scale and the impact of what you do just as an organization. Why don't you share some of the statistics or the projects that you've been engaged in and the types of humanitarian impact you've affected?
Sure. So just purely from an impact perspective, a field impact perspective, if we talk about that, it would be, you know, things like 6 million meals distributed around the world, mostly over the last 3 years, predominantly over the COVID period, it's been quite significant. The 100 school libraries that was reached last year, completed across India, is locations where we find out the poorest schools we can find, government schools, where nobody owns anything, they're government owned, and they've had a long history of being underdeveloped, and they're at risk of not future development. They have high dropout rates, poor quality of education, very poor facilities. So, you know, no chairs, no tables, no books, no artwork on the walls, no sports equipment, just sitting on the floor with basic text, dirty toilets, conditions. So, you know, we've developed 100 such spaces into flourishing, warm, welcoming places that the children can call their own and nurture themselves in the early years of their education. Digital education, we've delivered via smartphone devices during COVID. We ran a huge campaign that was supported by Uber and many corporates across India during this devastating last wave of COVID, which was in many ways one of the biggest humanitarian crises India's faced post-independence. With people, you know, unable to find hospital to go into. We had, you know, tens, if not hundreds of people dying during our relief effort, including our own CFO, Ronit Shah, who died in the process of that. So, you know, it was a very real, not a distant, it's not like, you know, sitting in the West and doing charity work abroad. It was this was our team members at risk and our families and friends who got involved, but it was a warlike situation that, you know, people really came forward to help. They gave their hearts, they did, you know, a lot, and it was, you know, really tremendous to be a part of that service and a blessing to help a few people during a very difficult time. Environment is a very key area that's we're focusing on, the awareness aspect of it, promoting changes to lifestyle that can reduce the impact of the environment on the environment. We're at COP26 and we held a conference called Ahimsa and the Environment, which was attended by COP President Alok Sharma and many other prominent members of Indian Parliament, as well as Gandhi family shared their view. So, you know, that's a conference we'd like to keep promoting, the idea of Ahimsa. So I think that the words that you use were really nice. Indic conception, but universal application really comes to mind. So those are some things. I think the campaigns are many, you know, from planting 2 million trees across the Sundarbans to food distributions in New York or London. The outlets are many. And, you know, it's like Sanatana Dharma itself, we pride on the fact that this is organic. It's growing out of nature. You know, it's growing out of people's hearts who want to come forward and help and grow these projects. So across the UK, there's 11 food distributions a week where thousands of meals are distributed by all of the volunteers serving homeless, vulnerable, families struggling for food. And it's just, for me, I just see it as an expression of love, the volunteers' expression of love, and also prasad distribution. That it's not us doing this, that we just want to put as many spoons out there as we can, and the prasad should flow from those spoons in all cities and all countries of the world.
Well, in many ways, the most impactful among us see themselves as instruments of something greater, and that is what powers them forth, whatever that looks like in various fields, various orders of thought and reality. Let me just clarify a couple things about the mechanics of the impact, and then we'll venture into the wonderful world of Indic thought. We are at war. There's a great war. There's a couple, three at least, but the primary one affecting the Anamaya Kosha, at least the body, is the global pandemic. And in times of war, Dharma is most slippery and most important. And so it's a fascinating analog. The Kali Yuga is upon us. We are in the middle of a battle without question. How do people get involved? How do they support? What is the call to action for those who've wished to get involved? Also, tell us a bit about how this has been built up. Who are these many hands who have joined forces with you to realize this noble vision?
I think the few things you raised there, I could probably speak about for an hour or two, but I'll try and be brief because I do tend to go on sometimes. But my spiritual teacher, Ramdas, have you heard of Ramdas?
I have indeed.
Yeah, great. So Ramdas said this wonderful quote, in Kali Yuga, my work is love and compassion. And in Sat Yuga, my work is love and compassion. So, you know, regardless of the condition, our job is to love all, feed all, serve all, and be happy that we are doing that work, regardless of the changing conditions around us. We'll still continue to do that work. And people often say to volunteers that, hey, you did tremendous work during COVID period. But actually, that work was also going on, perhaps in a different way pre-COVID. It's just that, you know, they might have to do more of it, or it's more visible because the global attention or media is on that. So just this week, there's been 11 food distributions, but people perhaps have now slipped more into, you know, focusing on what they'll be watching on Netflix rather than, you know, the disaster situation that could be arising in different places. So people's attention is largely driven by media. When there is a crisis happening, then they will look at what charities are, and volunteer groups are doing in that way. But otherwise, I feel nothing stops. You know, we these are Neem Karoli Baba's word, my Guruji, and he said, love all, feed all, serve all. That was, you know, very simple message. And that's what we try to do every day in a very universal way. The volunteers come from every background. We have Muslim volunteers, we have Jewish volunteers, we have atheist volunteers, we have people from every country, every place, every race. We come with an assumption that we are all one, Sabek. And Sanatana Dharma or Dharma is universally applicable for all of us, as if gravity or any other universal idea should be. We just come with that assumption. So I think rather than, I really feel that, you know, Indic conception, as you say, or Indic thought or Sanatana Dharma has been put in a box by us as well as by Western traditions. And we see it through the framework of how Western traditions might see themselves. But I feel like when I read what the Buddha wrote, or when I read ancient Jain texts, they spoke about Sanatana Dharma as well, that universal part, which is applicable to all traditions. And I feel that, you know, we come with the assumption that Sanatana Dharma is all of us. It's all beings. It's all, including nature, all animals, the earth, and everything. And that's our assumption. So we don't ask, is this for Hindus or is this for Buddhists and this for Christian or Muslim? We are all one, sabek, as Maharaj would say. And so our volunteers are very diverse, often from different places in the world, different traditions, some just purely from a business perspective that they've come in just to deliver social action in a particular finite way and help us to deliver that. And others purely from a spiritual perspective that they've, you know, studied yoga their whole life and this is their way that they want to express service for a wider community.
And so how do individuals contribute or get involved?
So we have a GoDharmic app, which is available by the, there's an advert there, for anybody that does want to volunteer can download that app from either the Apple Store or the Play Store, and they can become a volunteer, and a volunteer coordinator will then reach out to them to find the most local group that they can become a part of and join and, you know, help to establish either food distributions or volunteer in other ways. Like, you know, it could be digital broadcasting, or it could be finding ways to share messaging that, you know, is in line with promoting the ideas of Sanatana Dharma and the core principles of GoDharma. They can also, you know, help online or offline. It could be either some people just want to help with a fundraiser. One lovely gentleman, we call him Janaka, but his name is Barry from Gudrian, Barry Gudrian from Netherlands. He ran a marathon across the Himalayas, and then he ran a marathon across the Antarctic for GoDharma to raise awareness during things. You know, it's not something I would easily pick to do, but that's his expression of love and how he wanted to raise awareness for the planets, for the environment, and to kind of during World Leaders Day, COP26, he was running a marathon across the Antarctic. So very varied approaches to delivering social action, love and compassion.
How did this get started?
So I heard a Hanuman Chalisa from Krishna Das many years ago and burst into tears. Like, I didn't have any interest in Hindu thought, spirituality. I was a trader working in the financial markets in London, and burst into tears, literally, after hearing that, crying like a baby. And within three days, memorized that Chalisa, Hanuman Chalisa, and then found Ram Das, found Maharaji Neem Karoli Baba, and Krishna Das told me many years, that was your phone call. You know, you received Maharaj's phone call. And, you know, since then, GoDharma just started from the confluence of ideas with Dr. Nicholas Sutton, myself, this Maharaji influence, and, you know, being at a time where I felt that, you know, a lot of our lives are driven by the quest for artha, prosperity, and karma, pleasure, as opposed to dharma and moksha. I think there's a real imbalance, as perhaps somebody like myself who grew up in the West, everything was about either pleasure or prosperity, and not so much about responsibility, duty, family, thinking about peace or, you know, calmness or love for all beings. This is not what they teach you in school in the West. And I feel that there was that imbalance, and GoDharma was a confluence of ideas out of the OCHS, Neem Karoli Baba, what I felt young people needed. And they really do, I'm really inspired by how young people can actually think on their own two feet without leaning on tradition to think, hey, you know, why are we eating animals? How do we reduce the harm that we cause to the planet? And, you know, being at COP26 and seeing all these young people marching for the planet, whereas my generation, probably previous generations, are much more passive in their outspokenness towards this huge crisis that we face, is really inspiring, and Dharma in action. And I'd like to see more of that.
Fascinating. So now we have a good sense of the genesis and the work of the organization, and we now know how folks can get involved. Let's talk about the overlay of, as you say, or perhaps as I said that you said, the overlay of the Indic conceptions of Dharma. So on the one hand, there seems to be no restriction, obviously, in terms of whom you serve. It's whoever is in need. On the other hand, the very frame of it calls folks to a particular religious tradition and the theology, philosophy thereof. One might make the argument that these values are universal insofar as compassion, serving others. One needs not read the Gita or the Quran or the Gospels of Jesus Christ to have a sense of these values. One could well make that argument. When one is called to go dharmic, is one also being called to be Indic in some way?
One can be, but that's an optional aspect of whether you feel that speaks to you and whether that's your call. I think Maharaji always said, Sabek, you know, can't you see? It's all one. Who are we to create any differences? So our job is to see God in every living being and to see them in every way. And as soon as we start, you know, creating or seeing that difference or differentiating, then we are not doing our job in that way. So, you know, for me, I don't entertain the question of difference. I think Morgan Freeman said a really interesting thing during the Black Lives Matter movement, and I think it was, and he said, well, this will all go away when you stop referring to me as black, when you just see me as one, just as a human being. And so I make that assumption with Sanatana Dharma that, you know, that it is all one. There is no difference between us. I don't want to see a difference between anybody. And therefore, when we see each other as one global family, that is the expression of Indic thought. I think that way is there. And second thing, I feel like this question only arises when we use a non-English terminology. If we use English wording, like if I called it helpothers.com, nobody would say that, oh, you're using anglicized thought to express your social service. But the fact that it uses Indic terminology, we raise a question and say, is this something which lends on Indic thought? Why do we do that? It's a global expression. It's a normal thing. If somebody says dogood.com, you say, oh, this is a Christian faith-based or, you know, westernized faith-based tradition. They just consider it a global tradition. So all of a sudden, I feel that rather than, you know, everything that is anglicized is usual, normal, acceptable for the world, and everything that is Indic is somehow niche or, you know, for a particular group. And I feel we don't need to do that anymore. You know, we just need to be, and everyone can enjoy that. And India is like, has so much to give to the world. And I think Ram Dass, when he was at Harvard, he said this, you know, everybody at Harvard seems to be as neurotic as each other, teaching psychology to one another. And India has the maps of consciousness for the world. And I just love that, you know, we're all just neurotic as each other. Let's find those maps and share them for the world's benefit.
So let's talk a little bit about these publications that were co-authored with Dr. Nicholas Sutton. Let's maybe start about the most recent one, because it directly pertains to you bursting into tears from that cosmic text message from hearing the Hanuman Chalisa that was obviously shaktified, if you will, by someone's grace. And so tell us about this Moving Mountains.
So Moving Mountains, Krishna Das has written a beautiful foreword for it. And it was Hanuman Chalisa that most impacted me. Perhaps not even just the words of it, but the message within it, or the carrying Shakti, as you like, through it. You know, it had that emotional charge to give a lot of inspiration. And even today, millions of people chant that text, which is not often studied within academia that much. It's not given so much airtime if we consider, how many millions of people around the world chant the Hanuman Chalisa. I feel it's very underrepresented in terms of airtime on academic study. And because it had so much of an impact and so many people know it, like one of the things Nick spoke about in his talk on the Hanuman Chalisa, he said that when he talks about the Gita, very few people even know a verse, you know, or two verses of the Gita. But as soon as he started on the Hanuman Chalisa, he said, "I'm going to recite it." And everybody in the room was singing. You know, it was remarkable that even with all of the trauma of what Hinduism has faced over the last 1,000 years, we have texts that complete groups of people will know and carry forward. And that Chalisa, I really wanted to find the heart of it.
So does it consist of a translation, a commentary, a synopsis, your rendition? So what is the nature of the publication?
So it differs from the first two publications that we did. Me and Nick have an extraordinary friendship, connection, so much love. And the first two books we spoke
like Krishna and Arjuna, there's
there's so much love, you know, and in the first two books, we really spoke as one voice. You know, we wrote the verses together, we decided on what would go in, and it was literally one voice, but two authors contributing. In this book, we separated, and we wanted to give two contrasting views. So we have a translation, we have the text, we have a transliteration, and then we have Nick's thoughts, which perhaps lean more to giving more like the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies courses, a slightly more academic viewpoint, and still with a directing towards Dharma, because that's what Hanumanji represents. Working for Dharma in the world. And then from my verses, much more about Maharaji, Neem Karoli Baba, much more about the tradition of Hanuman and my personal bhakti towards Hanumanji and Ram and how that expresses itself. But at the same time, we both meet in terms of that we come to social service and love.
I just find it fascinating for a number of reasons. Thankfully, I tend not to interrupt my interviewees and I don't share all the thoughts that fire in my brain, but a number of things come to me as you're speaking. One is that sambandha, that is that connection that two people can have, co-authors, whatever. I mean, a number of fields. It's quite lovely when it's clear that, you know, a child is authored by two parents. But what's fascinating to me is hearing the very intelligent division of labor between yourself and Nick, because I find that happening in myself when I'll do academic teaching at the OCHS or in credit places, and there may be a question about spirituality, and then we'll code switch and say, well, tradition says this. Or I'll teach at my online school and we are teaching in the modality of wisdom, transmission wisdom teachings, sort of, you know, the spiritual value utility of this. But then we'll switch and say, well, no, Hanuman Chalisa was from this period, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's fascinating to see it done probably more elegantly by two separate people. But this code switching is something that just is day in and day out for me. And it's nothing that I can fully reconcile, but I think both sides are crucial.
They're absolutely crucial. Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that because I think the switch that you may see between academia and spiritual lenses is sitting with two versions of you, which you should both love. Ramdas used to say to me, I love you as a father, I love you as a husband, I love you as a teacher, I love you as a leader, in all of these different roles. And I feel like I'm a Westerner, at the same time I'm Indian, at the same time I'm Hindu, at the same time I'm all of these and none of these. And, you know, being comfortable with all of these different perspectives is okay.
You're a child of the global village, indeed. No, this crucial, I love what you say about the textured nature of the human complex and the aspects of self that need to cooperate. And this tension is particular in that the academic lens pertains to what we can observe empirically through history, what happened in the material realm, and how do we make sense of it through culture, right? And the spiritual lens, for me in particular, has to do with the inner life, states of awareness, insights, life wisdom, how to make meaning of what's happening on the ground. And I think they're both crucial. I think it's challenging to bring them together. I think there are those who are quite spiritual, but they may or may not struggle with the scholarly side of things. And there are those who are quite scholarly and spirituality or spiritual thinking might be a struggle. And so I find it quite fascinating that you both commented on this book. I want you to expand on a particular point you made in passing. You know, Hanumanji is all about Dharma. You know, why don't you expand that bija for us?
Yeah, I think as devotees of Neem Karoli Baba, many people used to consider Neem Karoli as a form of Hanuman, many Westerners came to him, whether it's Steve Jobs or Westerners have traveled to the Kenchi ashrams, like Mark Zuckerberg, Julia Roberts, all these different Westerners. Even Ram Dass himself left Harvard and sat touching Maharaj's feet for the next 2 years. And one of the Westerners came up to him and asked, how can I raise my Kundalini? I want to raise my Kundalini. And Maharaji gave him the answer, go and feed the poor. And they were like, food? What do you mean? I want to, you know, have some special mantra or some technique that's going to uplift my Kundalini. And he's telling me to go and feed the poor. And it was I really look at that and think, he's trying to change the question. Take it, it's not about you. The ahankara, can you relieve that by serving others and giving the others? And I think Hanumanji does everything in service. You know, his example is so relevant, even if you're an atheist today in the world, to see that level of selflessness and giving and service. And I just love that at the end of the Ramayana, particularly in Ramcharitmanas, when Sita Mata is giving the gifts to everybody, and he's given this jeweled necklace, and he's chewing it, and Lakshman is laughing and asking him, what are you doing? Why are you chewing this necklace? And he says, I can't find the names of Sita and Rama in that necklace. And then he laughs and says, do you have it inside your body? Why don't you eat your own body? And then he rips that in that famous image that we have of Hanumanji with his chest open and God within. That just speaks volumes to me. And I think his example of somebody who's lost himself in love, lost himself in service, in devotion to God, and expressing that in many different ways. So like moving mountains, we all know that famous biblical phrase that, you know, if you had faith, you'd move mountains. And then you have this example of Hanumanji going, he's not a doctor, he's not a medic. He doesn't know how to cure Lakshman. But he goes and picks up the entire mountain and brings it. And this is Godharmic, right? Like this is, we may not know the answer to every question or solve every problem. Poverty is a complex issue. Feeding a child isn't, right? Like, you know, we're gonna pick up the mountain and bring it. And if we can do something, we will try our best to. If we have the grace and the fortune and blessing to do that service, we should.
And you certainly seem to be moving mountains in terms of the relief that you're providing through Godharmic, and it certainly seems to be powered by faith or devotion at very least. So it's a fascinating metaphor for what you are doing with your humanitarian work. there is this, it's a book, I've done a couple of academic books, and I've just finished one for the public, and it's about stories, you know, the ancient Puranas, the epics. It's called, what is it called? I should know the name of my own book, The Stories Behind the Poses. So we talk about the stories behind 50 yoga asanas. And there's this pose called Hanuman pose. And the pose is the practitioners essentially in splits, sometimes with Anjali Mudra. And it's a story of how on earth could he cross the ocean to find Sita? I mean, he was at this impasse, but through his faith, he took this flying leap. And powered by the faith, he actually was able to traverse the ocean and land. So you're... There are all these fascinating vignettes. Wow.
I'd love to read it.
Yeah, so would I at some point. I think it'll be I think it'll be out in the spring. It's my first non-academic book. It's for more of a practitioner crowd, particularly yoga practitioners. But nevertheless, it retells 50 vignettes from the Puranas and the epics, so it might be of use to anyone who really wishes to study such things. But just, I couldn't help but call to mind the image of literally of Hanuman Asana while you were talking. So, in terms of the book, who do you think would most benefit from the book? Who's the book for?
I think thousands of people around the world, particularly from Krishnadas's kirtan, as well as many kirtan people who have attended kirtans across the Western world, have come into contact with the Hanuman Chalisa. I think many of them would find it interesting because they found so much love from the text, from singing it, but not necessarily meditating upon the words or understanding those words. There is a big audience of people who may find that interesting. And I think also millions of people have come into touch with the idea of Hanuman around the world. And this Chalisa about giving us so much energy. So I think anybody who wants to understand selflessness, understand how to serve in the world, can look at a book like this and, you know, understand how the Indic conception of the most wonderful selfless servant and superhero and saint and God acting in the world for positive social change and action can derive so much inspiration from that. So I think with all three of these books, often we haven't written them for any particular person in mind. We've almost wanted to study that and wanted to share that and then, you know, just produced it. So the Pearls of Wisdom from Hinduism was like, you know, people don't have time to study all these texts. Let's compile key verses that we feel very powerful and inspirational and bring them together in a Sanatana Dharma Sangraha so that people can read and memorize a few verses at least and carry them forward and maybe plant the seeds for future exploration. Such with this Chalisa, maybe people will explore the Ramcharitmanas after the Chalisa and can really dive deep into the ocean of Rama's love and in a way which inspires them to help others love all, feed all, serve all after.
Is there anything else that you wish we touch on regarding the books or the mission?
Well, one other book actually that is in progress, which has been something I found incredibly difficult to work on, is a book called Be Yourself. In the series of Ramdas's books, Be Love Now, Be Here Now, I had a series of conversations with Ramdas back in 2014 and at his home in Maui. And we explored the Upanishads. And we wanted to show that universal relevance for being yourself. But so that is something that I've been working hard on and looking for inspiration to be able to bring that to presence. So I think books are really important. The work that you're doing is wonderful, and I deeply appreciate everything that comes out of the OCHS. You know, it's just such a blessing for this planet. And in whatever little way we can contribute towards that, we want to, if it helps to establish Dharma, whether it's academic or whether it's spiritual, in the end, both should work for the benefit of all living beings and create flourishing and joy and happiness for all as the end in mind.
Beautiful. I think that's a lovely thought to end on. So thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Raja. I really appreciate your time and all of your efforts and work in this way.
My pleasure. For those of you listening, once again, I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar, and we've been speaking with Hanuman Das, the chairman and founder of GoDharmic. Just go to godharmic.com and you'll find ways to participate, and you'll certainly learn more about the impactful humanitarian work that's being done there, powered by Indic conceptions of virtue and the like. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, and keep contemplating the power of Dharma. Take care.